Hello, this is Chris, and you're listening to the Global City Mission Podcast. Today, I'm joined by GCMI Executive Director Jared Looney. In my role as Operations Director, Jared and I talk a lot about the what and the why of what GCMI is up to. And one of our recent topics of conversation that I wanted to share with our podcast listeners is the whole idea of ministry contextualization. So welcome, Jared.
Thanks. Really glad to be here.
So this is something that GCMI, you know, and really before GCMI, like this is a kind of a key part of missions strategy, you know, going into a new city, going into a new place, like one of those first questions that missionaries are asking is like, what is the context of the place I'm going, the people I'm trying to reach, the local community, you know? And so as we've been talking over, you know, I mean, really since I started with the team, as we've been talking about, you know, just little changes within the ministry or a new team member joining a new city, like this is kind of this recurring topic. So I really just wanted to kind of break it down and, you know, for our own selves as a, you know, potential training resource, but like to go out to the world and to our listeners, like what does contextualization mean and why is that an important conversation for missions and ministry workers?
That's a great starting question. And there's a number of ways to answer it really. I think to try to put it simply, we're asking the question, how does the gospel enter a culture? So in other words, how do we communicate these truths about God in a way that a culture or a subculture can make sense of it? Mm-hmm. And then also as the gospel comes into a culture and there are disciples and churches living out faith, living out kingdom life within a given culture or subculture, how is the gospel embodied there in that culture as well? So I kind of look at it two ways. You know, one is transmission, you know, the messaging that we do and how do we communicate to different worldviews? And the other is, how does the gospel continue to kind of have flesh, take on flesh within that cultural setting, and represent, you know, be that kingdom outpost in a particular culture?
Gotcha.
And really faithful to both, you know, the scripture, to God's word, but also really true to the cultural context that it's in as well, where it's not something foreign. It's something that really does represent that culture, but then also certainly and first and foremost also represents, you know, the kingdom of God, you know, being manifest in the people of God.
Okay. Yeah. So I think, you know, in other circles, right? Like when we start talking about we're looking at culture and we're adjusting what we're doing, you know, it starts to feel like you're almost becoming, you know, wishy-washy, but that's not really what we're talking about here at all. We're really like, how do we stay true to scripture? We're still keeping mm-hmm. that firm foundation, but how do we communicate scripture in a way that the people are going to hear it as truth and hear it in that like holistic kind of way, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would even push that a little deeper and say that good contextualization is not only asking how do we embody the gospel within these cultural forms and cultural expressions and rhythms of a particular cultural context. It's also asking what are the ways that gospel needs to be countercultural here? Because I think in every cultural context, there are things that are going to be bridges for the gospel. There are cultural forms that the gospel can take and really, you know, use and you know, you see expressions of the kingdom be embodied in these things. There's also going to be you know, values or practices that are countercultural to the gospel. And yeah. One of the things that I like doing sometimes if I'm teaching a group of missionary candidates or a group like that, you know, interns, trainees, whatever, on culture is and on learning about other cultures and how do we communicate the gospel across other cultures. One of the things I like to have them do is look at their own culture first and say, where should the gospel be countercultural? Where maybe have we, reflected the gospel well within your own culture, but where have we maybe given into the culture and it's just become so normal in our churches, we don't even realize that this is actually, you know, maybe not contextualization, but kind of bending to the culture in ways that we should be countercultural. And kind of the word for that that's often used more academically is syncretism, where you kind of mix things that are both Bible and not Bible to become something other. And that's not what contextualization is. Contextualization is how do we communicate in a way that makes sense to worldviews? How do we embody kingdom life within that culture? Syncretism is when you do a kind of mixing that produces something that is wholly other, that's really unorthodox.
Yeah. No, this is ultimately part of what I love about the podcast is when we dive into a topic like this. You and I have had this conversation dozens of times, if not, you know, way too many times, just as we've talked about different things and, you know, how do we make sure that what we're doing is contextually, you know, useful in that space. And I don't think I've ever thought about it that way. And we've definitely not talked about it that way because we're trying to solve a particular problem. We're not just having this kind of academic conversation. But that's great because that countercultural aspect of the gospel, like we think about that a lot, not just GCMI and missions, but like even, you know, church workers, you know, pastors, like we think about that a lot. Of the culture we're going into, you know, that bad culture around us, you know, those people, you know, those pagans, those sinners, you know, but I don't think many of us stop and think about how should the gospel be more countercultural even to ourselves. And if you're coming from, you know, a small town in the South or, you know, Midwest, you grew up going to church, you grew up, like there's a lot of culture that feels like the gospel because it's church, it's, you know, it's the way we've always done it, but maybe isn't the gospel, isn't scripture. And, you know, are we pausing and thinking and reflecting on that? And that's probably a rabbit trail we don't need to run down too far, you know, for today's conversation.
I would just cap that off by saying that, that I think really good contextualization will both affirm things in the culture because there are bridges to the gospel in every culture.
Yeah.
And it will also, they're also just, you know, neutral forms, just artistic expression, et cetera. But then there's also things that the gospel will challenge in every culture. And every culture, there's bridges and barriers to the gospel. And so we need to identify the bridges. We need to understand the barriers. And that's going to be true in every cultural context. And what most of the time, our blind spots tend to be our own cultural context. I think that's very human.
So it's definitely, you know, it's definitely just human nature. It's not like an intentional, we're trying to make our stuff, you know, be right stuff, you know, but so there's a history of like bad contextualization, right? Like in missions, in I know when I was in school, one of the, you know, famous stories everybody wanted to bring up was like, you know, ministry in the Philippines where, you know, churchgoers were wearing three-piece Western suits and reading, you know, from hymnals. And, you know, and it's kind of an obvious bad example, but, you know, when we take our culture and impose it on somebody, like this is the challenge. And so you've had the opportunity, not just GCMI, but like in your own ministry to jump cross culturally a few different places. Like how has this, you know, coming out of that Bible college, missions, you know, learning experience, how has this topic of contextualization, how has that informed you jumping into ministry over the years?
Yeah. Well, first I would not want to claim it that I've always you know, claim that I've always done it well, but because I've worked in a lot of diversity and it's hard to be an expert in everything when a lot of different cultures are flying at you. And that's the kind of context I've been in, which is why I often try to encourage cross-cultural workers to, they may be working with lots of different people, but like try to get to know one or two of those really well, because that's where you can contextualize more deeply, okay. You know, kind of have a little bit of a focus area. I think I've tried to be very conscious of it in messaging. Certainly, I mean, one of the texts that has come out of the last, I want to say decade, 3D gospel, that kind of work on honor shame. Jackson Wu has done a lot of work on that. Jason Georges, if that's how you pronounce his name, I've only seen it in writing, with 3D gospel. There's been some good work done, and this is stuff that's been known in anthropology forever, but it's kind of brought it to the mainstream for cross-cultural workers that I'm really thankful for, is kind of understanding there's, you know, like honor and shame is very different than working in our kind of very Western individualized and guilt way of thinking.
Yeah.
You know, kind of in broader evangelical churches, like, you know, kind of innocence, guilt is the message, right? And but there's a lot of other cultures, it's just not how they operate. A lot of people, this is small, simple stuff, but like for me, I mean, I grew up in church and I grew up thinking about what happens after I die, like an obsession, you know, because I grew up in church. And that's what we talked about. But a lot of folks translate that into evangelistic practice where they'll go to someone and say, well, hey, where do you think you're going to be tonight if you die? And there are, you know, a billion, at least, if not billions, that they just don't think that way.
Right.
You know, and a lot of secular and a lot of Buddhist, a lot of different contexts, like, it's just not a question you even ask. And it seems strange to even be posed the question.
Yeah, it did.
And so again, it doesn't, and I'm not saying that question doesn't matter. I think it matters a lot. You know, we want everyone to be saved. At the same time, is that the right starting point with somebody?
Right.
If that's just not a question they're asking.
It's not necessarily a contextually relevant question. It is for people
it's
like
biblically
us.
Biblically relevant. Is it contextually relevant?
Right.
Yeah. So is it a starting point? Because one of our key things about like outreach is, let's start where people are rather than where we want them to be. You know, let's start where they are. And so we have to start where they are. And that's where the relationship begins. So one of the things that I really valued is we've done a lot of kind of your small group or simple micro church, house church, all those kind of things. We've done more inductive kind of discovery Bible discussion, and a lot of those things are kind of popular in missions world right now. But one of the things that I've really appreciated about it is I think when you have these small kind of open-ended forms, it allows for the people that you're working with to begin to live out discipleship in their context, and it can easily take on the local culture because you're not imposing a lot of extra stuff. Now let's make no mistake. No matter what we do, we're making choices. You know, do I use storying? Do I try to start in a home? Do we, you know, meet out in a park? Do we, use this language or that language if they have, like, a lot of peoples from around the world. I mean, not Americans, but a lot of people speak three or four languages. Like, what is the heart language, or do we use the trade language? Or, I mean, there's all kinds of different issues that come up, and I'm including here in diaspora context. I mean, in North America, like, I meet people that I'm just trying to figure out, like, if I want to get them a Bible, like, I don't even speak their language, but if I want to get them a Bible, like, well, which language? Because they have their tribal language, and then their the trade language, and then maybe the language forced upon them by the conqueror of their people, you know. And so, like, what Bible should I even get them, you know? And is there a translation available if that's the one?
if that's the one, is that even an option? And so then, what's the next best choice? So tell me a little bit about, you know, What does this look like? Like, we use this conversation regularly when we're talking about, like, staff reviews, when we're talking about, you know, a new guy coming on the team. I think one of the things where it feels a little circular, but is actually a great argument for why contextualization matters, is when we start talking about, like, you know, a potential new teammate and some of their things that they're excited about, you know, like they've seen so-and-so do this kind of ministry, or, you know, somebody else do this kind of ministry. And, you know, and like, we're behind those ministries, like, those are our people. And we kind of have a little bit of, like, you know, let's pause and talk about why you're going to jump in and do that kind of ministry. And just this whole idea that the approach to this neighborhood, this approach to, you know, what even looks like, you know, they're jumping into the same work, so let's use the same strategy. Like, why do we still kind of start with this contextualization question?
Yeah, I mean, there's so a few different thoughts come to mind initially, just kind of listening through your thoughts and question there. I think one, even if you're in the same community, but you may be encountering different subcultures, you know, we still want to say, you know, how do we communicate and express the gospel in this particular context, even if there's geographic proximity? I've lived and worked in communities that were, you know, had such diversity that, you know, you might have a ministry, you know, in the middle of a community where that ministry is connecting with part of the community because it has a particular cultural orientation. So, for example, maybe a church that's really connecting with, like, Latino and Caribbean populations, but there's also maybe like an Arab or a South Asian population, like, in the same community, or West African, and they're just not connecting with that population. And so there's actually a need for additional work, you know, to try to, you know, whether it's working in partnership with that church or it's a missionary coming in or whatever it is, you know, that there's still a need there. There's still gaps because they're killing it with this one population, but it's just not connecting with the other, you know, and that's because these are different cultures. I mean, it's not because anyone's doing anything bad. It's just because these are different cultures. So that's one thought that just comes to mind is, you know, like we talk about going into a neighborhood or a community or a city. I mean, geographic proximity doesn't mean that there's not cultural distance. And then also, I think sometimes in cities, if we're talking about city ministry, which is a lot of what we're doing, I mean, the one of the constant in urban societies is change. I mean, that's something we've certainly talked about before. And so sometimes if someone's doing ministry and a people group for a long time and someone new comes in, first, yes, they need to learn from the person with experience. Let's make sure to say that, you know, but at the same time, that new person may have a fresh set of eyes where the culture has changed around the existing worker. And maybe they've missed some things, you know. So, like, we always want that fresh set of eyes because, you know, we're in an urbanized society, a globalized society, and change is a constant. And then another thing that I think really has kind of mattered to us as we engage, you know, diaspora populations, you know, internationals that have migrated, that have moved, is in really diverse, like ethnically diverse, internationally diverse cities. You're really encountering a continuum of change. In other words, you have people that have come to the city and they try to continue to live their life as close as they can to their homeland. And then the other end of the spectrum, you have people that are working as hard as they can to assimilate to what we might call the dominant culture. And right. You have all points in between and people moving both directions, you know? And so there's this continuum of cultural change taking place. And so when we start talking about contextualization in a diaspora context, like in North America or places like Western Europe, et cetera, if you're talking about in a diaspora context, the conversation about contextualization is still an important one, but now what we're contextualizing is to this continuum of change. It's to people that are maybe even secularizing. It's to people that are holding on to their home culture, but not completely. And it's to people that are living between cultures. And so you're still contextualizing that, but it's going to look a lot different. You know, where there's a lot of people that may not be ready, you know, just to jump full into to their new culture they're in. At the same time, there's folks that are that do want that, and it's just such a mix that what you're contextualizing to is this continuum of change and all the different places people are along that continuum, and that's going to be true about just culture and cultural change that takes place in urban settings and cities. And when I say urban settings, I mean like the metro area, because a lot of growth of international communities is taking place in suburbs in North America right now. So we're talking about metro areas.
Right. Right.
But thinking about cities that way, I mean, there's this constant cultural change taking place. So you may have a passion for a people group, but in some ways you're talking about people groups.
Yeah.
You know, even among first generation immigrants, because they're, and then especially when you get into like, you know, the their children that have grown up or were born here, and are definitely living between cultures.
Yeah.
You're engaging the same people group, but they're all across the continuum in terms of how you connect with them, what church expressions will look like, how you communicate the gospel, you know, how much do they, how much are they trying to cling to their social and religious identity of home? How much are they exploring new possibilities, you know, new identities? I mean, it's all across the board.
To kind of jump back to your earlier example, like a particular community, the church is finding success with, you know, Caribbean, you know, Latin, you know, but what you're saying here is like that same church who thinks they found success with, like, maybe it's even a specific island, Spanish speaking from this island in the Caribbean, you know, but because of this continuum of change, they might only be finding success with a percentage of that island, that people group.
Yeah.
And in order to really, you know, to really reach out and reach that community, like they're going to have to continually reevaluate.
Yeah. Well, I'm hearing some of this cultural change from people that are working in more like in some of the overseas context in the Middle East. So, you know, I mean, I've worked for a number of years in really international cities in North America among, you know, global populations. But, listening to some missionary types that are working in some Middle Eastern context, what they're encountering is, you know, they historically maybe used a lot of bridging. So like going from, you know, the Quran that people already have kind of in their psyche, and then trying to bridge that to the gospel and kind of, you know, help them see, you know, Jesus as Messiah and you know, that kind of approach. But they're finding the younger generations, and I'm not talking about the ones moving to Europe, North America, I mean, still in the Middle East, they're finding younger generations that are secularizing. And so the approach is less religious dialogue, and it's more how you'd start with a secular person, you know.
So even before they move,
in Middle Eastern context.
Right. So even before they potentially,
that's some of the population,
right? Yeah. So even before they potentially move to the U.S., you know, not that they're necessarily going to, but like before that moment, because we know we've seen that in immigrants is like you've got that kind of two extremes of some want to be a part of, you know, the American experience, and some want to, but even before, we're seeing that kind of that transition change happening.
Well, and even here, same thing, right? So these were international students. It was four Hindu guys from India, and I had a Bible study with them. And I would say the four guys, one of them, before even coming here, was already secularized. Like he really wasn't a practicing Hindu. He didn't believe it. He was really secular. He was what we might call post-Hindu, you know? And then there was another guy in the Bible study that clearly was religiously minded, really seemed like he probably practiced Hinduism pretty regularly. You know, he was definitely a part of his worldview. He was familiar with all the various, you know, aspects of faith. And then the other two guys, I'd say, were kind of in between. These are just four guys, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, one of the stories I sometimes tell is in a diverse setting, you have to be ready to turn on a dime. So I had two guys I talked to, both from the same region in Northwest Africa, both from Muslim backgrounds. One guy, I was making references to, like, you know, from Quran to the Bible, and we're kind of having a very religious discussion. And he was very open to me, and you know, we had a really good talk. And it was kind of that textbook, conversation for a lot of that kind of dialogue. And then another guy from the same region, I'm going to meet up with him. And after he had been doing some English with us, and I go to meet up with him, and we're going to have a faith conversation. I'm getting ready. I mean, I'm really not like my specialty is not, you know, Islamics, but I have, you know, just enough to, I think, knowledge of that to be able to have some of the conversations. And so, you know, I'm getting ready to have that conversation with him and getting my Islamics ready. And turns out the guy's really secular and even been atheist for a period of time. And really was kind of what we call kind of relativist, like just kind of all roads lead, you know, and,
right.
You know, maybe somewhat secularized. And I had to pivot and have a completely different conversation than what I was expecting. Now I know how to have that conversation too, but it just wasn't the one I was expecting, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the challenge, I think, in a more globalized world. I don't think that is, that does not call for a lack of contextualization. It just means we're contextualizing to something different than a traditional society. We still need to pay attention to the worldview of our listener. We still need to think, you know, what are the right, you know, forms and rhythms and messaging that really connects with people and helps communicate the truth of the gospel in a way that makes sense. And it expresses it in the various subcultures that we encounter in a way that that continues to be a witness for the gospel among their peers. We still need to do that work, but we're just doing it, you know, a little more messiness.
Right. And probably a good point to make is like, this isn't a, you know, one and done kind of thing. Like when you moved to New York, you didn't look around, do a little bit of contextualization work, and then boom, done. This is my ministry now. When you moved to Tampa, same thing. You didn't go like, now I know my city and I can just do this one thing. Like this is a continual process that you're engaging in as you move around the city, right?
Yeah. I mean, you never stop learning.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So kind of the two questions that we sort of, I wouldn't say we ask them like word for word, but the two kind of ideas we hit some of these topics with as we go through the podcast. One, if GCMI is moving to a new city, we've hired a new missionary, we're moving to a new city, and we'll just leave it random and blank, you know, not anything in particular in mind, but, you know, like what would be those first steps, you know, whether that's, you know, we pack you up and move you to a new city, or, you know, we're coaching somebody in the process. Like what would be those first steps? How do I look around and really engage in this process?
Yeah. I mean, first it helps just to know who's there. And sometimes there's, you know, like demographics and articles and study and research on cities that have been done, but sometimes it doesn't exist. I mean, sometimes like a particular population is actually fairly new to the city and hasn't really been documented well. I found that coming to Tampa. I knew there was an Arab community here. I had no idea how large, because there just wasn't much out there. And I came down here talking to the ministries and they were like, they're estimating, you know? And so, So, you know, I think first though is, you know, trying to figure out who's there. And so some of that may be, you know, things you can do online and demographics. I mean, that if you can find those resources, I mean, use them to help begin to create the picture. But then there's no getting around putting feet on pavement, you know, and just trying to kind of figure out who's there. And a lot of times if there's a particular, like, you know, global people, diaspora community that you're looking for, I mean, or just trying to discover, I mean, you know, usually if they've gotten at least a little bit of established, there may be, you know, some businesses, some religious bodies, some associations, you know, restaurants. I mean, restaurants like that are embedded in those communities for, you know, those communities. You know, finding places of business is often helpful. That's not necessarily the end result of your ministry, but just as a starting point where you can ask some questions. And that's a lot of what you want to do, is you want to begin asking questions. In cultural anthropology, we talk about ethnographic research, and all that really means is simply learning about another culture. And so, and really, I would argue that needs to be like a pastoral practice. And what it entails is learning how to observe the culture around us, uncritically, like just observe it to learn it. Not passing judgment yet. What I often tell people is look at the culture, the different cultural things you're seeing around you, make notes of them, write them down, but just describe it, interpret it later, you know, make decisions about ministry later. First, just observe it uncritically. What is it? What is going on around me? You know, what do I see? And then you're going to try to understand what does it mean? If you go into some businesses, there's all kinds of different symbols of value or religion or things, you know, there's like sometimes they're like, you know, different charms and you don't know what they are, but that they're serving a function,
right?
In terms of spirituality. And so trying to learn about these different things and a lot of that is first it's observation. It's what people call participant observation. So you're getting in there, you're mixing with people, but you are observing and taking note of what you're experiencing. And I would even argue that these kind of practices we need to do, even if you're in a cultural context that looks a lot like you, if you're trying to connect with non-religious people, religiously, that's a different culture.
Right.
It's a different worldview.
Right.
And so you need these skills here in North America in a homogenous community where people look like you. If you're going to reach the non-religious, you need these cross-cultural skills.
Right.
You need to learn them. You need to study them. You need to put them into the best way to learn them, put them into practice, you know, trial and error. And so you're going to observe what's going on around you, take note and just describe, and then later go back and try to gain meaning from it, understand meaning. And then learning to ask good questions. I mean, open into questions, asking people to describe things and describe their experiences. Trying to understand the meaning of different things, essentially trying to get their worldview. And then when you're getting understanding that, how do I begin to communicate the gospel, into this worldview, into these values, into what they're seeing? And I try to encourage people as a starting point, what is good news to this people? And sometimes when we encounter other cultures, we have a little culture shock and we just want to bring the conviction. We want to bring the conviction. And here's the thing. Let's not make a mistake here. The gospel convicts. And if someone hangs with you long enough, there's going to be some conviction. It's going to come out. I mean, you can't avoid it if you're going to really engage the gospel fully. But when I read the Bible, I often see that the starting point was, what is good news to these people? And so I try to encourage, like when you're encountering a community, I don't care if it's a homogenous community that looks like you and speaks like you, but who are the non-religious in that community? That's really religiously a different culture, or whether you're really crossing cultures like internationally, ethnically, in a diaspora community. You really want to begin asking the questions, how do people think? What do people value? What are the big questions? How are decisions made? I have a good friend. He runs another mission agency. He directs her. He was a founder. He's in some role now on another mission agency. And he was working among West Africans. And so as people were beginning to come to faith, he's working in the U.S. The families are back in West African countries. And so now you have like essentially transatlantic conversion negotiations. That sounds like a mouthful. But in other words, like the family negotiating, are we going to adopt this faith as the family with an ocean separating them? Because Americans, it's in our movies, it's in Hollywood, it's in our media, it's in our values, it's in our songs, it's everywhere. We are autonomous individuals. We make our own decisions. That's not everybody in the world, And so like asking the question, how are decisions made in this community? So if conversion is going to happen, how does that happen? What are leaders in this community? If I want to develop leaders among this community, all those questions. But the first questions, really, going back to your question, like the first questions we might even ask is, how do I access relationships here? Like, what do they do? Are people hanging out at the soccer field, or, is it the coffee shops is it through like a felt need, the English classes? What is it? Like, how do we even access these relationships? That's a big starting point.
Yeah, I think the thing that I want to point out, and I know this is part of where we have the conversation internally, but I know this is a lot of the conversations I have with other pastors. What you didn't bring up in any of that was program, strategy, methodology, and I think, you know, like, so like in our world, you know, where this comes up is we're encouraging a new mission catalyst not to go, oh my gosh, Dave is doing great work on college campuses doing ABC. So I'm going to go and do Dave's work at this other place. We're encouraging them, why don't you go visit the campus first and see if, like Dave's work might be exactly what you need, but it might be all wrong. And let's start with who's there and what's the best way to reach them. And all those questions that you just brought up, all those.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something we do in the American church quite a bit, I think. And I'm not wanting this to sound critical, so please, everyone, show grace, but we shrink wrap things so fast. We kind of put it to market. There's a method. We put it to market so fast. I think what's behind that is there's a story, right? A narrative. Like, there's a story of a ministry that really made an impact. And usually that means typically that means it grew, you know, it really made an impact. It affected a lot of people positively. A lot of people came to Christ. I mean, it really made a kingdom difference. And we take that story, we try to make a template out of it. And the only places where that template really works well is when it's a close enough cultural context to the original, you know, that it might, you know, it might kind of work. And I say might, not necessarily, but it might kind of have some similar, not even the same usually, but some similar results, because it's very, you know, maybe we get lucky, right? And it's just a very similar cultural context. What happens to a lot of people is they try to apply this template, and it's just different contexts, it's different circumstances. And sometimes we work in too many generalities. We think, oh, this is the same culture, so it'll be the same. Like, maybe it's, I don't know, like, oh, this worked among Mexican Americans in Houston, so I'm going to do this among Mexicans in New York. Well, that's a different Mexican population. Right. Or Mexican right. LA. Well, that's a different population. It's a different city. It's different circumstances, different migration history, different other cultural groups that they're, you know, colliding and merging with, and, you know, and then
the city dynamics are so different on top of that. And
they're so different.
Yeah. But, and it's definitely, think,
you know, and my original team, when I first went to New York, we kind of laughed about it a little bit, because we were raising funds, we were raising support as missionaries, and then we were going to go to New York City. And we had to kind of present a plan, but we would kind of laugh about it. Because, you know, we had studied missions in school, and we were kind of going, man, like, we're all of our training has said, go and learn the culture and contextualize. And we have to present something that is already thought through, you know. It's like, so I guess what do? We throw this out? I mean, you know, so it's kind of an odd thing.
Yeah. The other question we ask a lot, right, is like, if you're sitting across from that pastor, grabbing coffee, talking about his community, his ministry, what would you say to them? And, you know,
yeah, I would say, get out in the community and find people, find ways, whether it's the local gym or community center or out on the street or coffee shop or whatever the, you know, maybe program, you know, talk to people that are in programs, whatever it is, like, however you access that community, because it's going to be different communities, but however you access people in that community outside of your church, you know, and people in church too, but I'm thinking especially about majoring and people outside of your church, is and just learn to ask open-ended descriptive questions. You know, hey, tell me more about this. I want to learn about that, and try to learn as much as you can about the community. And then I would say, do it again and again and again in repeating cycles, because there's a good chance in a lot of places in our society, this won't be true everywhere, but it'll be true in a whole lot of places, that, you know, if you're there for X number of years and you haven't done that in a while, that community may have changed around you. And so we constantly need to relearn it. I would, you know, we're trained to talk in ministry. We're trained to be talkers. We really need to learn to be listeners. I mean, generally, unless you're in a counseling program, you're not being trained to listen. Let me confess, that is not my default skill. It's a discipline, you know? And so anybody that knows me knows I'm a talker naturally. And so when I'm listening, it means I have flipped the switch and I've disciplined myself to listen. and so we have to learn how to practice that discipline of listening. And so we can really learn about people and where they are and connect with them where they are. I would also say we can't be afraid to make mistakes. I sometimes feel like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth because I'm like, let's try to do this really well and let's really speak to the culture. And on the other side, but don't be afraid to make mistakes because we all do, you know? Yeah. But I think we at the end of the day, we have to be courageous. I mean, I'd rather someone try with really Christ-centered sincerity. I'm not talking selfish ambition. I mean, Christ-centered sincerity. You know, with Christ-centered sincerity, I'd rather them try and try and try and make tons of mistakes. Because I also think that other people from other cultures, especially if you're in a multicultural context, like most of our cities here, I mean, you know, people from other cultures, especially if they're not from the dominant culture, because if you're not from the dominant culture, in the U.S., like you already are, you're already cross-cultural because you have to deal with the dominant culture at the very least. And so not to mention neighbors of other cultures and things. And so people that are not from the dominant culture, they already run into mistakes. They already run into faux pas and they already run into sensitivities. And if you come across with sincerity, and I mean, and if that sincerity is real, I think people show a lot of grace. So I would also want to encourage people to be courageous. Yes, always be a listener, always be a learner, but also be courageous. Yeah. You know, like don't be afraid to be bold. And you know, if you make mistakes, then don't be afraid to be humble. You know, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, as someone who's, I've spent most of my professional career, ministry career in churches and church contexts, and I think one of the things I'm learning as I continue to have conversations with other pastors, but living in this world, is also as you're reading those leadership books, as you're going to those conferences, dive into the why of what's being taught, what's being presented, mm-hmm. and less the what, you know, because mm-hmm. I think our tendency, and this may even be true a little bit in the missions world, right? Is like we go to this conference, we hear about, you know, oh, this church started a food program, and because of that food program, all these people came to Christ. And this, you know, mission in India started, you know, maybe it was a well drilling program, or maybe they started a hospital. And so, like, our ministry should start a hospital because if we start a hospital, like, people will come to Christ. Mm-hmm. And that might be true, but what's the why? Because the ones that, you know, like, and I mean, you can only speak to so much of your own experience, but I know, like, you know, the church that I was at the last 10, 12 years, we had, you know, a missions program, like a lot of churches do. And we were working in Kenya, and we were, you know, kind of busting our butt in Kenya and, you know, having a little bit of progress. And one of the trips, actually a women's trip, like a group of women went there and said, oh, we're missing the point, which is funny in and of itself because all these men had gone on all these trips and never saw it. Like, what these communities need in this particular region of the world and this particular tribe and this, what these people need is they need wells because the water is killing them. And if we put in wells, that'll be the thing that, you know. And it worked. Like, all this great work came out of it. Mm-hmm. But it came from doing work in the field. But if you hear that story at a conference, you're tempted to go, because I've told that story to people, you're tempted to go, yeah. Oh, like, well, maybe our ministry should do wells. Like, because our people struggle with water too. And like, well, maybe, and maybe yeah. you should, but like, but what's the why? Like, how did we get there? And we got there by caring for people and for, you know, And you know, and I don't think that's the way our conferences are set up. I don't think that's the way the books that we read are written. They're written to go, here's the 12-step plan of how your church too can be as cool as mine.
I mean, even building like ministries building wells, and which, you know, is literally saving lives. But there's also a rural assumption under that, right? So, I mean, what about cities that have infrastructure? Right. Maybe what's really needed is like advocacy and a better infrastructure, you know, because everyone should have access to water. I mean, in the shanty towns, they may not, but certainly like in the city, you know, the main part of the city. Or maybe it is like the infrastructure needs to be expanded to the shanty town, you know, and maybe there shouldn't be shanty towns. You know? But all I'm saying is there's different kinds of questions for different contexts. And a lot of times the ministry we're one group may be doing, we look at that and go, great, I want to do that too, because that looks really awesome. But then, you know, we're making all kinds of assumptions, and we need to stop and ask, well, what's the thing that we should be doing? And, you know, I'm all about reaching as many as possible, saving lives, you know, bringing people to Christ, all those kinds of things, you know, developing communities, all the stuff that great workers and great works are doing. You know, I think there's a lot of good kingdom work. But I'm also, I also think we need to put things in the right order. You know, what works is an important question. What's faithful is a better question. And we can ask both, but let's put them in the right order, you know? And I think that's important.
I mean, gosh, there's so many rabbit trails we can chase down here, you know, both in terms of the history of GCMI and how we do training with churches and, you know, partner alongside other organizations. But I'm glad that, you know, we're able to kind of, you know, scratch that surface and kind of dive into it. I think this is such a important part of, you know, the behind the scenes of what we're doing. But it's one of those odd conversations that I definitely have regularly with churches, that I definitely have regularly when I'm out at a missions conference, of, you know, both understanding their context for my own, you know, my own interests, but helping them to ask those questions and kind of, you know, engage their community in a new and gospel-centered kind of way. So hey, we're gonna leave it off there for today. Jared, thanks for jumping in and having that conversation. There's definitely a lot more to talk about here. If you're interested in this idea of contextualization, if you're in a place where you're looking around your city and you're going, man, how do I do this better? We'd love to talk with you. You can hit us up on the website, you know, send us an email, you know, send us a message. We'd love to chat. We'd love to plug you into, you know, one of our, you know, training opportunities, if that's the right next step for you. Importantly, make sure you go to globalcitymission.org/podcast. If you're not already subscribed, there's links to a couple different podcast platforms, and you can definitely look it up on several others and get yourself subscribed so you don't miss the next episode. And we look forward to talking to you soon. See you later. Bye.